Every morning, you wake up and reach for your phone. Before your feet touch the floor, you've already handed over the first minutes of your day to invisible merchants trading in the most valuable currency of the modern age. This isn't an accident. It's the result of a carefully engineered system that's been perfecting itself for nearly two centuries. What began with a simple newspaper trick in 1833 has evolved into a sophisticated apparatus that shapes not just what you buy, but how you think, feel, and experience your own life. The question isn't whether your attention is being harvested, it's whether you'll ever get it back. In 1833, Benjamin Day's New York Sun pioneered a radical model: sell newspapers below cost, build massive audiences, then sell access to those eyeballs. Day wasn't selling newspapers, he was selling you. Competition drove content toward sensationalism. The Sun published fantastical stories about bat people on the moon and lunar unicorns. Pure fiction, but circulation soared to 19,360, making it the world's most read newspaper. This revealed something profound. Our brains evolved to notice movement, bright colors, sexual imagery, and threats, exactly what advertisers learned to weaponize. By the 1860s, Jules Charest transformed Paris with 7-foot posters featuring half-dressed women in brilliant colors. These weren't advertisements. They were attention traps designed to catch wandering minds. Paris fought back with attentional zoning, restricting poster placement. What's striking is the speed. For centuries, religion dominated human attention. Within decades, commerce had become its fiercest competitor and was winning. In August 1914, Lord Kitchener launched history's first systematic civilian propaganda campaign. His iconic poster, featuring his stern face pointing directly at viewers with "Your country needs you," exploited the psychological power of direct eye contact and personal accusation. The results were staggering. By late 1915, roughly half of Britain's military-aged men had voluntarily enlisted despite facing a 50% chance of death or injury. When America entered the war, it scaled these techniques dramatically, producing 75 million publications, organizing 75,000 speakers, and creating wildly successful propaganda films. Observers drew opposing lessons. Walter Lippmann grew cynical about democracy, arguing consent had been manufactured through stereotypes and emotional manipulation. Edward Bernays saw commercial opportunity, becoming the father of public relations by applying wartime techniques to consumer goods. Adolf Hitler, writing from prison, praised British propaganda's simple presentation of love and hatred, lessons the Nazis would perfect. By 1935, Hitler's voice reached 56 million Germans simultaneously, with Joseph Goebbels declaring radio capable of creating one public opinion and destroying the spirit of rebellion. The machinery of mass persuasion was built and would never be dismantled. After World War I, advertising transformed into respectable science. Industry revenue doubled between 1918 and 1920. By 1930, it had increased tenfold. Claude Hopkins's 1923 manifesto, Scientific Advertising, declared the field had reached the status of a science. The 1920s introduced three revolutionary approaches. First, demand engineering, creating desire for products people didn't know they needed. Listerine transformed from battlefield disinfectant into a cure for halitosis, exploiting social anxieties. Between 1922 and 1929, its earnings skyrocketed from $115,000 to over $8 million. Second, branding, fostering loyalty by creating the impression that identical products were unique. Third, targeted advertisements aimed at women who controlled household purchasing. Despite popular belief about Freudian influence, leading firms embraced behavioral psychology. J. Walter Thompson hired John B. Watson, who stated, "To make your consumer react, it is only necessary to confront him with either fundamental or conditioned emotional stimuli." By 1928, advertising spending exploded from $700 million in 1914 to nearly $30 billion, about 3% of GDP. Advertising now saw itself as capitalism's priestly class. In 1928, failing toothpaste company Pepsodent gambled on Ammos and Andy, a radio serial attracting 40 million nightly listeners. Their sales doubled within a year, proving an industry could own time slots and breach the barrier between public and private space. Broadcasters colonized daytime with soap operas, seamlessly integrating products into storylines until entertainment and advertising became indistinguishable. Television's adoption was swift, from 9% of homes in 1950 to 72% by 1956. Shows like I Love Lucy became bait for commercials as American advertising spending quadrupled to $6 billion. Leo Burnett's Marlboro Man campaign increased sales by 3,000% in 1 year. The living room, humanity's last refuge from commercial intrusion, had fallen. The late 1950s saw the first resistance. Zenith Radio created the Flashmatic remote, shaped like a revolver, to shoot out ads. Vance Packard's The Hidden Persuaders exposed advertising's psychological manipulation. The 1960s revolution promised liberation from manufactured desires, yet failed because most people never stopped watching. Attention merchants recognized that desires for individuality could be channeled into consumption. The revolution would be televised, then monetized, then forgotten. When Steve Case became AOL CEO in 1991, getting Americans online seemed impossible. Unable to match competitor spending, AOL bet on electronic community, letting users entertain themselves through chat rooms and unlimited email, centered on the famous "You've Got Mail" greeting. AOL's 1993 promotional floppy disk campaign achieved an extraordinary 10% response rate. Expanding to CDs, AOL's logo appeared on 50% of CDs produced worldwide by the mid-90s, logging subscribers every 6 seconds. AOL discovered something profound. The greatest allure of computer networks was social interaction itself. When Facebook launched in 2004, it recreated bounded social communities where students quantified friendships for validation. As one Stanford newspaper noted, "Nothing validates your social existence like the knowledge that someone else has approved you." Facebook's allure was offering users an augmented representation of themselves, not as they were, but at their contrived best. By 2012, Facebook had 845 million monthly active users through a grand bargain, access to friends in exchange for demographic data and targeted advertising. Unlike traditional attention merchants, Facebook ingeniously turned users into renters, improving their landlord's property through constant updates. You weren't the customer. You were simultaneously the product and the unpaid labor force. Watch any street corner, heads bowed to screens, the culmination of 2 centuries of attention harvesting. By the mid-2010s, news sites triggered 20 tracking messages per visit, building dossiers exceeding government surveillance. Yet, hope emerged. Netflix's $100 million bet on House of Cards in 2011 rejected advertising, proving people craved immersive experiences. Releasing all episodes sparked binging. Audiences wanted sustained attention without commercial interruption. History demands caution. The attention merchant industry has been left for dead 4 times, only to resurge stronger. What's needed is a human reclamation project, conserving mental space as a vital resource. This means setting aside blocks of time beyond merchants' reach, reclaiming sanctuaries like classrooms and homes for concentration. William James observed that life ultimately amounts to whatever we've paid attention to. Every moment scrolling is a moment not spent living. The machinery is sophisticated, the pull strong, but the choice remains yours. Reclaiming your attention means reclaiming your very experience of living.